in my career. So, but in the back of my mind was, well, okay, Lenny doesn't want to build models, but maybe we could build someone else could come in and build models. And another fellow, Jim Axe, who was quite a famous mathematician, left Stony Brook to come and he did build some models. So those next years was a combination of fundamental trading. I did venture capital. I invested in all kinds of things. But the models kept being built and working better and better. And finally, at the end of about a 10-year run, it was clear to me that this gut-wrenching business of fundamental... I mean, you know, if you're doing fundamental trading, one morning you come in, you feel like a genius. You know, your positions are all your way, and you think, God, I'm really smart. And look at all the money I made overnight. And then the next day you come in, and they've gone against you, and you feel like an idiot. We were pretty good at it, but it just didn't seem to be a way to live your life, you know. So building models, go with the models. So by 1988, I decided it's going to be 100% models. And it has been ever since in the business that we built. So some firms, you know, investing firms say, oh, they have models. And what they typically mean is, you know, we have a model and it advises the trader what to do, and if he likes the advice, he'll take it, and if he doesn't like the advice, he won't take it. Well, that's not science. You can't simulate how you would do. How were you feeling when you got out of bed, you know, 13 years ago when you're looking at historical simulations? Did you like what the model said or didn't you like what the model said? It's a hard thing to back test. So if you're going to trade using models, you just slavishly use the models. You do whatever the hell it says, no matter how smart or dumb you might think it is at that moment. And that turned out to be a wonderful decision. So we built a business 100% based on building computer models, starting in those areas that I mentioned, currencies, financial instruments, gradually moving to stocks and finally to anything that moved. Well, it had to be tradable, it had to be liquid. It was always liquid. But you know, bringing in data. In those days, we sent gals down to the New York Federal Reserve to copy histories of interest rate numbers. I mean, they didn't exist in the 70s. You couldn't go and buy data, and there was certainly not online deliveries of all this stuff. So to build the original models, we needed to collect a lot of data by hand, which we did. But gradually, you know, we got smarter, the models got better, we brought in more and more people. We have the best math and physics department in the world at Renaissance. I don't think that's quite true. On the other hand, it ain't bad. We have a lot of smart guys, and we certainly hired people who were good at that kind of work. So we started this thing called the Medallion Fund in 1988. In 1993, we closed it to any new investment by outsiders. Just employees could invest. By 2002, we started taking out the outsiders altogether, buying them out, and by 2005, there weren't any left. So since then, the last 5 years, this vaunted Medallion Fund has been owned 100% by the employees, which today are about 300 employees. And, well, so people would always ask me, well, what's the secret? How come? Because we're not the only quant firm in the world. We're not the only guys who have, you know, made models. I disparage some who model making was sort of a part-time thing, but there were certainly other outfits. But we seem to have done better than anybody. We had really established a remarkable record. So people always ask me, well, what's the secret? You know, what are the secrets? Now, of course, I'm not going to tell you the various predictive signals and so on and so forth, I'm definitely not going to tell you. We'll keep that. That's even bigger secrets than that. Their stuff down there at IDA. These secrets are we try to garden them. But the real secret sauce is that we start with great scientists. We start with first-class people who've done first-class work, or we believe have reason to believe will do first-class work. And because I was there at the beginning and a few other people who had been pretty good at math and science, we had good taste, and that's stayed with the company. The second thing is we provide people with a great infrastructure. And I've had people come to us from all over when they come to work and say they never saw. It's more easy to get to work here than any place else. The data is easily served. We have an alumnus here that I saw earlier who could testify to that. I'm not going to ask him to do so, but he would. So the infrastructure, give people a good infrastructure. And I think the most important thing that we do is have an open atmosphere. So my belief is the best way to conduct research on a broad scale is to make sure, as much as possible, that everybody knows what everybody else is doing, at least as quickly as possible. Sometimes you get an idea, you want to keep it to yourself for a little while, you don't want to look like an idiot, but the sooner the better. Start talking to other people about what you're doing, because that's what will stimulate things the fastest. No compartmentization. No, we don't have any little groups to say, this is our system, and we developed it, and you run it, and we get paid based on that, and so on. None of that. Everybody meets once a week. All the researchers meet. Any new idea gets brought up, discussed, vetted, and hopefully put into production. So it's an open atmosphere, and people get paid based on the overall profits. You don't get paid just on your work. You get paid based on the profits of the firm. So everyone has an interest in really everyone else's success. And those policies, no one of which seems so remarkable, turn out to be a pretty winning combination. Great people, great infrastructure, open environment, and try to get everyone compensated roughly based on the overall performance. And that's worked, and it continues to work. So that made a lot of money. It made an awful lot of money. So we started a foundation, my wife and me, in 1994. And at first it was, I believe, in her dressing room, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right? She had this little box with the folders in it. And she didn't even have that big a dressing room, so it was a tight quarters. But gradually it expanded, and she hired a few people and then a few more. So we have this foundation, which has actually grown quite considerably, not only in size in terms of dollars given out, but I think in terms of sophistication. And it's great. So, you know, my first career was a mathematician, and my second career was this business of being a businessman. And now my third career is kind of being a philanthropist. And so what does our foundation do? Well, it's one of the very few, I think, that's focused almost exclusively on basic science. So we support basic mathematics, basic physics, a lot of biology, but primarily it's serious research across the board. We have an autism project, which is interesting, but we do it from the ground up, understanding the genetics, trying to understand the neuroscience, and get insight into this condition, which will provide insight into how our normal brains work. So we're focused on basic science, and that's very gratifying. Marilyn and I can feel good about that approach, we do other things as well on a smaller scale. But that's the, and I don't think there is. We were talking to some people the other day. There's probably not a foundation of our size that is as focused just on basic science. Now, at first, we gave to institutions. We gave some money to MIT there. We did help the math department. I think there's a few endowed professorships here and so on. But in later years, we've been more focused. We've been focused on the making bridges between mathematics and physics and the life sciences at the Institute for Advanced Study and at IHES in France. That's been an important, and at Rockefeller, that's been important to us. The autism has been important. Now we're getting more focused in math and physical science, looking at individual projects. MIT has an application to us, into us for a theoretical computer science institute, and they're not the only applicant, as I know they know. It's a very good application, I have to say, but I also have to confess that there are a few other good ones, too. But some place is going to get a great institute for theoretical computer science. So those are the kinds of things. Those are the kind of things that we do. And so I retired from Renaissance at the end of 09 and have never been so busy. People always say, well, now that you're retired, you know, what are you doing? I'm busy as hell. So, you know, even we have Math for America, something that we started 7 or 8 years ago to try to improve the teaching of mathematics. Everyone's concerned about the American kids and mathematics education. Well, we've taken the view, so we have a narrow view. Our view is have teachers of mathematics who know mathematics. Now, you might think, well, of course, but regrettably, especially when you get to high school, the majority of the teachers of math actually don't know much math. So that's not a productive environment in order to stimulate the kids in learning math or science or anything else. I mean, you sign up for Italian lessons, you know, you don't want a Chinese speaker, you want an Italian speaker. You know, a guy with an Italian book says, well, I'm learning this, and don't, not to worry. You'd say, you know, I'd like somebody else, please. I'd like somebody else. But the kids don't have a choice in the matter. So so we're trying to do that, and we're doing it. Okay, so why don't we have enough? I don't want to dwell on this point, but why don't we have enough teachers of math and science in the high schools who know the subject? And one answer is, well, if they knew the subject well, they'd also know enough to work for Google or Goldman Sachs or God knows where, because today the world is so much more quantified and the economy is so much more based on quantitative methods than it was 30 or 40 years ago. So the difference in the quality of the job, the pay and the respect is so great for someone who's actually qualified to do a good job of teaching high school mathematics that they get pulled away and don't often find themselves in the classroom anymore. So you have to make the job better. That means pay these folks more, which we do in New York through our program and a few other cities, and provide them more respect and support, which we do. So, you know, if you pay a guy 25% more and make him feel, or her, feel special, all of a sudden, the career is a lot better. If you make the career better, people will stay in the career. If it stays the way it is, people won't stay in the career. And if we don't do something, it isn't going to be a good situation. So this is something you probably all have given some thought to. So I'll conclude this. I was talking to my wife about this talk and what I might say, and she said, well, you know, you should end with values. I said, I'm not sure I have any values. She assured me that I had some values, if only I could think hard about them. So I guess I do have some values, and I think they have guided me. So I'm calling them guiding principles. Values sounds like a very serious business, but I'll tell you some guiding principles, which I think have worked pretty well. So one thing I've always done is do something new. I love to do something new. And I don't like to run with the pack. For one thing, I'm not such a fast runner. So, you know, if you're one of N people all working on the same problem in different places, if it were me, I know I'd be last. I'm not going to win that race. But if you can think of a new problem or a new way of doing something that other people aren't all working on at the same time, maybe that'll give you a chance. So do something new. Second, collaborate with the best people you possibly can. When you see a person, get to know a person who seems like a...